Roth, 6 a.m., live in front of your naked, steaming eyes. It's 8 o'clock. The first day is half over. This job's a breeze. Everybody told me this was heavy lifting. Heavy lifting is dragging an oxygen tank up 23 floors in Co-op City, okay? And everybody in the 47th precinct knows what I'm talking about, and that's why I got this job. I have a very special guest here. Somebody very close to me, and he's the very first guest of what is probably going to be a fair-sized run in radio here, and there's a reason that he's here. He's the only guest today. In fact, he's probably the only guest for the first 2 weeks. More about Chernoff later. Ladies and gentlemen, my very beloved, the patriarch of our entire family, Manny Roth. Say hello, man.
Hey, good morning, David. How are you doing?
I'm doing extraordinary. Hey, now tell the people.
Let me congratulate you on your new gig.
Okay, and do you think this is a good look for me? What do you think?
Well, they rushed me up here. They didn't give me time to think. Is that the theme of the program here?
Thinking? No. Nice try, though. No, the theme of this gig is this is a culmination of, you know, why do things? Why have the stories if you don't have a place to tell them?
Well, I got a mother load of stories here.
Okay.
I ain't saying the good, I ain't saying the bad, but I got a hell of a lot of stories to tell you.
Tell folks, where were you from, Manny? Where are you born?
Well, that's not the main story, but I'll start back at the beginning here.
Okay.
I'm from a little town in Indiana, a blue-collar town, Newcastle, Indiana.
Newcastle, Indiana is still there, right?
It's still there, and it hasn't changed. It hasn't changed for 80 years.
Now, the last time that you guys went to a class reunion, half of the city square was a class reunion and the other half was a Ku Klux Klan rally. Is that right?
Well, you were there.
In spirit. No, people wonder what this looks like. And to my greatest memory, it looks like the movie Hoosiers, where Gene Hackman was in. That's that part of the country breaking away.
Exactly. Well, that's the order of things in Newcastle, in Indiana. Basketball, God, country, God,
Mom,
country, and family.
Mom, God, and apple pie. What year were you born, Manny?
I was born in 1919.
When did you first get laid?
When?
Can you remember? I know what year I did. I know who the last one was, and your wife is there.
Let me answer the question. Well, it was in 1928, the summer of 1928.
What was her name?
Her name was Maxine. 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 Do you guys know what a brand new large foam rubber pillow feels like? I mean,
I kind of know what's coming here.
That was Maxine. I mean, this was the best summer of my life, David.
And of your entire life?
Of my entire life.
All your life in front of you. Huh?
I was. She was an older woman. She was 10, and I was 9.
And this was the year before the stock market crashed in 1929, right?
I think there was a connection there.
The earth shook. Did you keep up with Maxine?
No, it was only that one summer. I've been spending the rest of my friggin' life looking for Maxine.
Trying to replace her, huh? For me, it was Jeanine Scott, that first inimitable kiss. Huh?
Yeah, Maxine, bless you, Maxine, and thank you, wherever you are.
She set you on a great journey, huh?
Oh, yeah.
All right, what was...
I've never been able to replicate it.
Ever?
Ever.
And was this... Where was this? Was this out in a field, or was this...
No, it was in the garage.
And what kind of car was parked in the garage?
Well, now that's another story. Dad had a 1922 Phaeton Buick. Do you know what a 1922 Phaeton Buick looks like? It's like one of those gangster movies out of a 1920s black and white movie. You know, a four-seater, front and back, with the cloth top on it.
Oh, with a really long front
with
part.
With a long front and the running boards.
Bless you. How much did a car like that cost? 1928.
Oh, God. I remember that one probably cost a little more. That was an expensive car. But you could buy a Ford, a Model T Ford, for $500.
Amazing. Yeah. And was there a stereo in these cars? Did they have radios in cars at that point in time? That's a real question. Shut up, animal.
No, David, that's not a real question. Sure, they had stereo. They had the air conditioning. They had what else? They had the directional thing that all the cars. No, they didn't have any. They had a crank in front so you could start the thing.
Really? Like, yeah. Like we seen
in. They didn't have a self starter. They didn't have anything. They were really bare bones.
Okay, and you were telling me that at that time, though, there was FM radio, no? Direct.
Well, no, that came a little bit later. Yeah. Initially, I told you that my baby brother was on FM when he was in high school. Now, that had to be, let's see, I was home on leave. That had to be the late 30s or early 40s.
When did you join the Air Force, Manny?
In the early 40s.
And did you join because of the war?
No, I joined because of the uniform.
I get that. It's part of the reason I got a job as a singer. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, it was the wings. That turned everybody on. You know, first of all, I have to tell you the story. I was going to the University of Miami, and they sent this crew down to call out the people who could qualify for the Air Corps. The Air Corps was the elite. Yeah. And you had to have a little college training. And then they put you through an exam. And I remember my eyes weren't perfect. And I saw that on the chart. My eyes were something like 20/25. And going down the stair, they gave me the chart to carry. And I carried it down the stairs. And on the way down the stairs, I changed the numbers. I made my eyes perfect. And that's the reason I got into the Air Corps. And then they took me in. And all the time I was going through basic training, I don't know how I did it, but I managed to fake the eyes, the eye chart.
Okay, now did you know when you took your entrance exam that you were going to be in flying in airplanes? Did you know that in advance?
I wanted to. I wanted to be a pilot.
And did you know that the smartest guys were saved to be navigators?
Well, no, but I found that out later when I washed out a pilot training.
Well, that's what I mean.
Well, they sent me to navigation school.
And you were a navigator.
And I was a navigator, yeah.
What kind of airplane were you flying?
I ended up flying a B-17 bomber.
Wow. Can you describe what a B-17 looks like for everybody who doesn't know? Can you explain that?
Well, the B-17 bomber is a four-engine plane.
Is that propellers?
Oh, yeah. Four-engine propeller plane. And it's an exciting-looking plane. It really is. It's a great-looking plane. And I'm not sure what I think the... I'm not sure what the make of the engines are, but I think they're 12,000... not BTUs, horsepower.
12,000 BTUs is what they use over at the Four Seasons to cool the shrimp cocktails. No, it's 12,000 BTUs is what they charge.
Engine, yeah.
In Eurocoin.
And you get in, the navigator gets in a hatch, and you got to be...
A hatch underneath?
Well, there's a hatch toward the front of the plane, just about so square there, about a foot and a half square. And you hoist yourself in. You got to kick yourself up and then pull yourself in. Then there's a little alcove up and a little desk up in the front of the plane where you sit and you lay your maps and your computer and all your equipment out. And that's what you do.
What was the name of your pilot?
This is a great one. Whenever anybody comes up with a crazy name, I can always top it. Okay. I can always top
okay,
it.
Okay, now
ask me again what my pilot's
okay,
name.
This was what year?
This was 1942, 43.
Okay, 1943.
Ask me what my pilot's
name. What was the name of your pilot?
My pilot's name was a Canadian guy, and I loved him. His name was Basil H. Cockshot.
That's so Revolutionary War, right? Why do you ask, two dogs? Screw it. Why am I named that? That's amazing. Did you keep up with him?
Well, I saw, you know who too found him for me? My son. I got a son, and he was always excited about what was going on over there, although it was mostly nothing but friggin' boredom. You know, you're waiting around, waiting to go. Boredom and fear. Fear.
Sounds like the road.
Yeah. But my son found him. He went into the records, and he came up with him. And lo and behold, Ted, we nicknamed him Ted. We couldn't call him Basil, right? I mean, especially when you were out walking the streets in London there trying to pick up chicks. You couldn't meet my friend Basil.
You're right.
So we called him Ted.
And you were stationed in London at that time?
I was stationed in Bury St. Edmunds. Bury St. Edmunds.
Do you know where that is, Hutch?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, Bury St. Edmunds. Beautiful little town.
The 94th Bomb Group.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And what kind of missions did you go to when you flew away
from missions.
Were you scared?
Oh, you bet your ass I was scared.
That's a common thing. There's no such thing as absence of fear.
I mean, when we were going on the bomb runs and the flak was coming up and the fighters were coming in there, I'm sitting up there. I'm saying, God, if you're really up there, let's make a deal here. I said, I'll become a priest. Get me out of here.
You would have killed Grandma. Shema Yisrael. Go ahead, talk. Grandma is rotissering in the grave even to hear that.
Just get me out, please. Get me out of this one.
And when you would take off, where would you go to? You would fly from London across the water to where? Germany? To France?
All over. We went all over. We went to Munich, Frankfurt, Berlin. I'll tell you the scariest missions. Scariest missions was when we went down to bomb the sub pens in the south of France.
Kept the submarines.
Yeah. And why was that was a bitch, man. I'm telling you, that was a bitch because we carried napalm and those things leaked.
Jellied gasoline.
Yeah, they leaked. And you could smell them the minute you got on the plane. And they didn't have to tell you not to smoke, but if there's a spark on that plane, I mean, arrivederci, Roma. And they were low level. Low level.
Like how high off the ground?
We went in like 5,000 feet.
And you dropped bombs from that high?
From, that was for the pens. That was for the sub pens. And I'm telling you, that was, you breathed a sigh of relief when you drop those napalms. The napalm, that was rough stuff.
And you were involved in the approaches to Berlin, yeah?
Yeah. I'll tell you the time I claim closest to cashing it in.
Tell me.
Well, you know, you take off for a mission, and you first of all, you get up like 4 o'clock in the morning. You go to...
Boy, tell me. Sorry, sir.
That was the hard part.
Whoa.
Tell me. Then they brief you, and then they send you out to the flight line. You do your checklist. And if you're lucky, if there's no hold on the mission, you get in. Well, this one morning, I don't remember where we're going, but we're forming up. First of all, we went up in a there's 9 groups, 9 planes in a group. You go up and you have a rendezvous point, and you form a formation. And
this is in B-17s with the propellers and everything. Okay, so this is every
with
movie we've ever seen.
With a bomb load.
Was
about 4,000 pounds.
Was a Memphis Bell the B-17?
Yeah.
Oh, so that's the Memphis Bell that we see.
If you've seen the movie, you've seen my story.
Oh, yeah. You bet that's that pretty plane where the nose sticks up in the air, and it's usually silver metal.
It's a great-looking plane.
Sure.
Anyway, to get on with my story, David. We were forming up. We're in the clouds, you know. And all of a sudden, I see out here under our left wing, there's another B-17. And I knew right away what was happening here. He was just moving over like this, just moving underneath us.
They can't see that on the radio, man.
Well, my pilot, well, he was right under us. He was about 11 o'clock high. You have to look at your clock to picture that.
Got it?
Yeah. And I know he's in a blind spot. My pilot can't see him. And I know he's situated where he can't see my pilot. He can't see our plane. And he's like slow motion. He's moving in like this. I know it's the end, man. I don't know what happened, but he missed us by inch. And I'm screaming over the intercom, pull up, pull up, pull up, pull up. And nothing happened, and this guy just slowly moved, right? About inches. And
so your own guy caused you the greatest fear.
Yeah. And, oh, I've got something I want to show you.
Tell me.
Do I have to explain it since there's no TV here? You know what this is, David?
Let me see here. I have no
idea. It's a mezuzah. You know what a mezuzah is.
Oh, okay. I don't know this shape of it. Of course I do.
Well, sure. I'm going to... We just moved out here, totally. My little peanut wife went back to New York, and she brought the balance of our archival stuff. And it's a ton of it, and this drops out. My mother gave me this to carry. I carried this with me on all the missions.
As a good luck charm.
As a good luck charm.
Well, it worked, huh?
It must have worked.
And you carried this on all of your missions,
huh? On all of my missions, so...
I'm a newly licensed helicopter pilot. May I have that?
Yes, you may. Pass it on. Good luck.
Thanks, sir.
Yeah, this is my good luck commission. Right? Good luck.
Let's introduce your wife here, Marlise. Say hello. Shout it out, kid. Come on, say hello.
Hello.
You go. So, at any rate, you stayed throughout the war there.
Yeah. Well, I stayed past the war. I volunteered to stay on after the war.
Why did you volunteer to stay on after the war, Manny?
Well, they were looking for guys to do special jobs after the war. And what they needed somebody to head up the soldier show division. Well, I'm Mr. Show Business, right?
That back then?
I graduated with a degree from the University of Miami, right, in drama.
Oh, I didn't
so
know that.
So that makes me Mr. Show Business.
Okay.
So anyway,
bless you.
I volunteered to stay over, and they sent me to Munich.
To do?
I was to head up the soldier shows. That's where all the shows for the troops.
USO.
USO mainly. And they came in and they quartered there. And we fed them. And we had our own little unit. And I was the only commissioned officer there.
What rank did you attain?
Well, I ended up first lieutenant. And I was the only commissioned officer there. And I had about 30 guys under me. And it was some fraternity, I'm telling you that. These were the dregs of the war. We had our share of alcoholics, and we had our share of layabouts, and we had our share of do-nothings over there.
I was in a band for a long time.
and we did. And... I can't think of any name except Lawrence Tibbett. Lawrence Tibbett came over there. But I was there about a year. And
Did Bob Hope come through there?
Was Bob Hope didn't show up. But let's see. Oh, do you know who I met over there?
Who'd you meet over
there? Well, it wasn't one of the stars, but it was Bob Mitchum's sister.
Okay. Allegedly, huh?
I know you're impressed.
I am so impressed. Hold that thought for 1 second. We're going to break for spots. I'm going to be back with my dearest Uncle Manny right after this.
David Lee Roth in the mornings.
Roth, 6 a.m. Roth, 6 a.m. Way too early for most, but not right here. David Lee finally on the radio, and I have a very, very special guest with me here. He's the patron of the whole Roth family here, and he's a big part of the reason I went into show business, and it's very symbolic that he's here today, because maybe this is the second half of the Super Bowl for me. Who has any idea? But radio was always in my future, and Manny, you're the good luck vision. If I amount to half of what you've accomplished in this magical world, then it'll be a really great day for me. My most esteemed uncle, Manny Roth. Say hello.
Hey, David.
We finished up at the end of the war, and you had finished. You were flying a Memphis Belle, and what happened then?
Well, the end of the I was with Soldier Shows. That's where we ended up. I was the chief of Soldier Shows. And our job was mainly do nothing, just be there. And we had a great show. We had a great show because we had all the celebrities coming through. So we could get strawberries in the winter. We could get ice cream. We could get anything you wanted when nobody else could get it. But anyway, I picked up the phone one day, and somebody says to me, "This is General Mills." I said, yeah, bullshit, General. I thought it was one of the guys in the group that had done a number on me. So it wasn't long after that I was headed for home. They cut my stay short in Wiesbaden.
Okay, and they sent you from Germany back to Indiana?
Well, yeah, they phased me out. Yeah, and we really had a nice comfort zone there in Wiesbaden. They gave us the Wiesbaden Opera House to function out of. And that was ours. Anyway, we left Wiesbaden, and I came home, and there was a small hiatus when I went back to Indiana. And then I figured this is not too exciting back here. You know, I'd left a very exciting venue, so I figured, What to do? Then I see where you could take the GI Bill and go to the American Theater Wing.
Where's the American Theater Wing?
The American Theater Wing is in New York City, and that time it was on West 44th Street.
And you came, what year was that?
And I came here in...
bless you.
I came here in 1950.
How much did an apartment cost in 1950?
Well...
Look at everybody's face. They're straining on that one.
Yeah, really.
Tell them where you lived in 1950.
Well, I came here and I got an apartment just off Sheridan Square on Christopher Street, 85 Christopher Street. I had a one-bedroom apartment with an eat-in kitchen and my own bathroom, of course, two-flight walk-up, but a huge one-bedroom for $39.67.
I can't even give you the coffee that I'm drinking.
I should have held on to it.
Yeah, and I should have invested in Microsoft. So.
Anyway, I was involved with a show. The reason I came back to New York initially, some people asked me to come back. They were doing an off-Broadway show.
How far off?
At the Theater de Liche, you know where that is? On West Bleecker Street.
Oh, sure. Now, I know exactly where that is.
What was playing at the Theater de Liche at that time was the Three Penny Opera. Now, that Three Penny Opera was an institution.
That's Mac the Knife, right? That's what Mac the Knife is from. That's how most people know that.
So. And it had been there for years and years and years.
A staple diet, like cats.
So we came in with our little show, and how they managed, I didn't do it personally, but they managed to dislodge the Three Penny Opera, and our show came in. And I remember we opened, and I remember the review in the Times said, "It's plays like this that give flops a bad name."
That happened to me my first three records.
We closed at after 2 days,
and that was your first adventure producing a play, right?
That was my first,
What was the name of the play?
The name of the play was The Homeward Look. Now,
boy, foretelling
the deemed. we did go home.
And you had a group of people that you were producing theater with? That was your ambition?
I wasn't the number one producer. There were a lot of producers on the show. But they let me, gave me a co-producer title.
There. Gotcha.
So, anyway.
Bless you.
I ended up going to the American Theater Wing off and on for about 4 years. And I worked with some really great people there. That was the time of Brando. I worked with Strasberg. I worked with Thelma Schnee, Will Lee, Herbert Berghoff, Uta Hagen.
These are all the most famous names who wrote the books that are now being taught in all of the drama classes and up at Columbia and everywhere.
But there was one fly in the ointment. I didn't have any talent.
I never let it hold me up, man. Just lead. Not for a minute did I stall. Must have got it from you.
Well, I didn't let it stop me either, David.
Damn the torpedo.
And I started making the rounds. I started making the rounds in the city there. And then, I don't know, you never made the rounds. You were a star day one. The minute you decided you were going to be a star, you were a star. Me, I wasn't a star, and I had no potential for being a star. So I was making the rounds there, and they look at you. They look at you like you're a prize piece of beef on the hook.
Well, you were trying to be an actor?
I was trying to be an actor. And I got a few gigs. I did a few things. The one job that I did, I didn't get this one because I was up for a cigarette commercial.
On television?
And I was smoking at the time. But you go in, you audition, you know how you audition, they make you smoke a cigarette. Well, I was smoking, I was a veteran smoker. But the minute they tell you to smoke a cigarette, you can't smoke anymore. I mean, you can't find your mouth. You can't find your face. You don't know what to do with a cigarette.
So what were you smoking? You have a few of those stories, too.
I did my share of those stories, David. I did more than my share.
You did part of my share, huh? It was your share I got busted with in New Washington Square.
Well, that wasn't too far from the Café Wa.
Yeah, I know.
Coincidence? I don't think so.
My God is a fierce and vengeful comedian. Old Testament.
So, and the next phase was I was living with a young lady by the name of Judy.
I remember Judy quite well.
Now, this was another Judy.
Uh-oh.
My life has been, now, I don't want to say infected, but I will say that there were a number of Judys in my life.
Okay.
And anyway, if you have to handpick somebody out of the whole world who is not my perfect mate, it has to be Judy. But we did. We had a good time. We had a lot of ups and a lot of downs.
How old are you guys?
Well, you got to remember now, I'm out of the war. I'm in my early 30s, and she was 19.
This is also a pattern. Marlies, do you mind my asking how old you are, sweetie?
52.
You're 52. You're just right. You're my age. Manny, how old are you?
Well, let me give you the premise here. I figure if it works for Woody, it's got to work for me, right?
There's 34 years difference. So my future wife just graduated from driver's education.
Well, I met her when she was 8 years old. I paid a ransom for her.
You brought her back with you. Huh? So this is like Woody Allen. What, are you raising her?
Ask my wife, who's the old one, who's the young one in the family.
I can tell the difference instantly. She's sitting here, controlling the room, and the rest of us are getting drunk on humor. This is amazing. Okay.
Well, anyway, we were together, Judy and I, this Judy, and for 3.5 years. And I'll tell you one thing we did that you should try sometime.
Tell me.
We went camping up on Cape Cod, up in Provincetown.
Been there.
Now, we did without money. We had no money. So I'd had an Army-Navy goods store in Muncie, Indiana. So I bought an old Army tent, I bought a kerosene lantern, and I bought a little ice chest. And I bought a $75 car, and we trekked up.
Stop right there. We have to go to commercials. $75 cars. I just want to dwell on that one for a second.
David Lee Roth in the mornings.
Roth, 6 a.m., free radio. What a long, strange bong hit it's been. I got my uncle here, Manny Roth, the reason that I got into show business. Don't blame him. I took the ball and ran with it in my own direction. Manny, it's good to have you here this morning. We've been talking about a little bit of the history that led you up to making history. Go ahead, take it from here.
Well, we got me to New York. We got me to the American Theater Wing. I couldn't handle the making the rounds. Before we go any further, David, I want to read you just a little note that I sent to my brother, Nate.
My dad.
Your father, yeah.
Okay.
This was on your birthday when you were born. Remember, this was around the same time.
Is the paper still holding together? What is it written on? Papyrus? What is it? Cuneiform? How do you keep a message that's that old here?
Well, it's in my archives. I depend on my little peanut wife here.
Okay.
Anyway, your sister Lisa gave me this.
Okay.
Anyway, after my failed production... at the Theater Delice.
You produced a play that bombed after 2 days.
And it got devastating reviews. And then you came into the world. So I wrote my brother, your father, a little note here, and said, "Congratulations, kid. Your production obviously was more successful than mine. Congratulations. Encore, encore. Love, Manny."
Well, I've bombed, but it took a little longer than 2 days from that moment. That's amazing.
Yeah, that was your birthday. Let's talk about the village.
Please do. Now
that's
tell
the most exciting, the sexiest, the most provocative. It was the time.
And what year was that, Manny?
This was, excuse me. This had to be the year 1958.
1958 was Elvis. That was Hound Dog, right?
Yeah.
Or 1956 was Elvis.
Elvis was happening. And times, they were changing.
Do you mean the Bob Dylan style,
yeah,
huh? Okay, yeah, this was the folk movement. Yeah?
He was on the scene. Anyway, there were a number of coffee houses around the village. We used to hang out at the Figaro. The Figaro was the central point.
Still there.
Most of the layabouts, everybody with a wonderful idea, all the creative people, all the do-nothings, everybody hung out at the Figaro. And it's still there.
Oh, certainly there. I've eaten there many times.
Yeah. And there were other coffee houses, but not many, like the Reggio. The Reggio is a little hole in the wall, and it's still there. And you can get excellent coffee there. Anyway, I see an ad in the Village Voice that what the hell was the guy's name? I knew the editor, the guy who...
Of the Village Voice?
The Village Voice.
Anyway, this is good, because they've been giving me grief lately. We're going to go all the way back now. I have a connection. This is a good interview. This is of value.
So I see this ad in the Village Voice. Somebody's looking to open a coffee shop. So this turns out to be a friend of mine, Rick Allman, who's opening a place called The Bazaar. And what's he going to do over there? Well, first of all, he's opening it on 3rd Avenue, right around, on 3rd Street, right around the corner from McDougal Street. And it's a big barn-like structure there, just south of NYU.
Okay, I know exactly where you're talking about.
What's he going to do there? He's going to do Grand Guignol Theater.
What's Grand Guignol Theater?
We all know what Grand Guignol is.
Well, I got a vague idea, but explain for those.
French scary theater.
Okay.
Yeah. Bloody theater is what he's going to do. What? And so the whole theme of the place is bizarre. Well, I walk in, and I see this empty cavern of a place and a couple of sawhorses with some boards lying across it. So he introduces himself. I'm Rick. I'm Manny. What are you going to do here? I'm going to open this coffee house, and I'm going to do this. Well, I didn't know what Grand Guignol was. Well, I did know what Grand Guignol was, but I played dumb. So I'm looking around here, and I said, well, what are you putting in? He said, what are you going to sell here? I said, we're going to sell coffee, and we're going to sell. I said, and how are you going to pay the rent? He said, don't worry about the rent. I need investors. Do you want to invest? Do you want to invest $500 in the next million-dollar enterprise? And I'm looking around. Now, Rick Allman was a street fighter type.
You don't have to explain. It sounds just like my agent.
So he says, do you want to invest? And I'm thinking, well, hell, I can buy my own sawhorses for less than $500. I can get a couple of planks, and I can sell coffee. I'll do my own coffee shop. So I went around the corner on Bleecker Street between Thompson and LaGuardia Place.
I know it exactly, and this is Classic Village for everybody who doesn't know New York too well.
There's a joke that goes with it. Tommy Ziegler, who owned the Figaro, was a friend of mine, and he thought it was a joke, because this was no man's land out there. And this was right across from the Mills Hotel, where you could get a flop a night for 50 cents, and the streets were littered with bums. Then it was like the Bowery. See, you youngster, you don't know what Bleecker Street was like back then, but it was really an offshoot of the Bowery. So I see these two premises there. It was called the Vatican City Religious Bookshop. Now, it was a mammoth business. They're selling religious artifacts. They had the two stores where the Bitter End is now. And the store next to it, they had the two rooms upstairs, and they had the two basement rooms.
Okay, well, that's the Comedy Cellar now. No.
The Comedy Cellar is on McDougal Street. I'm talking Bleecker Street now, where the Bitter End is.
All right.
Bitter End is kind of catacorner from where the Village Gate.
Who played at the Bitter End at that point in time?
Well, there wasn't any Bitter End yet. I later sold it to Freddie Weintraub, who opened the Bitter End. And he played essentially the same people I did. He played, I'm getting ahead of myself here now. Anyway, the Vatican City Religious Bookshop had a mountain. It ended up a mountain. I threw everything out of religious artifacts and Art Deco pictures. I mean, a mountain of original Art Deco pictures. There must have been a million of them. And I had a mountain of them. See, if I'd saved those... Well, never mind.
It's that eyesight again.
Anyway, I hold all that crap out of there. And all I had was an open room. And I didn't have any money. I went in there with about $2,000. That's all I had. And I went to auctions over on the Bowery, and I bought used kitchen equipment, and I installed it myself. I'd get a wrench, and I'd hook up a stove, and I did a little plumbing, and I did a lot of carpentry. And I bought, they were demolishing an office building, not too far from where I was. And what they did was scrape up all that dark brown vinyl that they had in the hallways there. I mean, it was just a heap of scrap vinyl. Well, I bought a couple of truckloads of that, and I got myself a linoleum knife, and I cut that up, and I laid that. That was my fourth floor there. And I went out on the streets, and I picked up broken furniture, and I brought it in. I brought in chairs. I brought in tables. I brought in couches. And those couches are another story.
Those are self-contained ecosystems, Nick. lot happened on those couches, huh?
They were at a premium. I had about a half a dozen couches. And we slept on them. I mean, I had some friends who, you know, they had to pick a ballot to get a couch to sleep on at night. And anyway, this was my first place.
They slept in the club.
They slept in the club.
And did you sleep in the club?
I slept in the club, too.
And you always had a couch.
Yeah, I was the king of the couches. I finally got the club open. We called it the Cock and Bull Cafe Theater, Cock and Bull, because I figured I was going to do theater there. I mean, nobody was going to reject me anymore. I wasn't going to make any rounds anymore. And I was going to do a little theater, you know.
An independent.
Independent theater. I was going to do whatever I wanted. I was going to direct. I was going to produce. I was going to act. I was going to do. Nobody was going to say, yeah, you're not the type, kid. So, anyway, I opened up, and I didn't make a lot of money. I made nickels and dimes at first. But the couches were always full at night.
Which is kind of the reason we get into show business anyway.
Yeah. Plenty of company.
There's a certain amount of that.
And this was over on Bleecker Street, mind you. And we started out. There were a lot of kids, a lot of wannabes, a lot of people who wanted to get involved in the arts, in the wannabe actors, wannabe sculptors, painters, writers, what have you. And they didn't have any money. I was selling coffee at 35 cents a cup then. They couldn't afford a 35 cent, so I banned them, right?
And there's that Roth thing.
Well, I figured, I got to pay the rent, right? Well, the Bannies, they organized, and they called them Manny's Bannies. And then they needed a place to meet. So they asked me if they could meet in the club. So I figured, well, let's see. It'll look busy. They're not going to spend any money, but it'll look busy. So I let Manny's Bannies meet in the club. And that's the way it all started.
And was this folk music? Was this acoustic guitars and harpsichords at this point?
This was nothing. There's another story. Everything's got a story or a couple of stories. But I ended up with a poet doing. And on Friday and Saturday, you know how the village is on Friday and Saturday. The people come in from all the boroughs. They come over the bridges and through the tunnels, and the streets are mobbed. So you can't, you open your doors and you do some business. Well, I'm still selling 35-cent coffee. But somebody gave me a microphone, and somebody gave me a little amplifier. So I built a little tiny stage. It was about, 8x8, about 2 feet tall. Just a little plywood theater. And I would get up there, and I would foomph with the crowd. Who are you? Where are you from? What are you doing here? What's your dream?
And how many years later did it turn into Hello, Cleveland? Don't go away. We'll be right back after this.
David Lee Roth, weekday mornings.